When Ori and the Blind Forest first released in 2015, it made waves for its beautifully realised landscapes and emotional narrative. Inspired by a number of classic platformers, gameplay concentrates on running, jumping, climbing, and shooting through a plethora of striking environments. It was developed by Moon Studios, who represent a collective of talented and experienced creatives from around the globe, all coming together for a single, breathtaking work of art. Music plays a gigantic role in Ori and the Blind Forest, which always sounds as gorgeous as it looks. Every step of exploration is scored by lush orchestral layers, sprinkled with synths and occasionally solo woodwind and vocal performances. Composed by Gareth Coker, the soundtrack is vital to the game's overall style. Such a strong aesthetic demands music to match, and Gareth's themes dance gracefully around the living, breathing world on display. His OST was quickly noted for its evocative melodies and rich sound, which is thankfully set to continue into the upcoming sequel, Ori and the Will of the Wisps. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in depth into video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. To finish up this pre-Christmas mini-run of ST2, Gareth Coker returns for his second and final appearance. Previously, we discussed the five albums of material he wrote for Minecraft, which already had an expansive soundtrack by C418 when he came on board. With Ori and the Blind Forest, Gareth was able to form his themes without the looming shadow of existing music. At the time, it was his biggest project to date. He had access to the Nashville Music Scoring Orchestra for the first time, and a lengthy development process meant that music was far from an afterthought. Instead, it was given the space to brew alongside other departments, deepening its connection to every aspect of the game. Although Gareth wasn't new to composing VGM when he joined the team, how did the sheer size of Ori and the Blind Forest impact his approach?
Honestly, because it was my first big project, I think what only became really clear towards like the last 6 months of production was just how much work it is, not just to deliver the music for a game, but how much work it is to ship a game, period. Frankly, it's amazing any game gets shipped at all. It's a remarkable achievement because there's so many different departments have to come together and produce something that works. My role didn't really change that much other than just like the workload I'd planned for and then the reality of that workload were two very different things, just because I didn't have the experience. Now for the second game, I've obviously been through that gauntlet, not just on Ori, but on several other projects. So I kind of know what to expect now. But for Ori, it was the first, you know, 2-hour game score that I'd ever delivered. And also the first recording with an orchestra that I'd ever delivered as well. So there were a lot of firsts on that project. And when there are a lot of firsts, there's always going to be a lot of unknown quantities and things you kind of have to figure out on the fly. But now, 5 years, yeah, we're pretty much 5 years down the line, I feel like I know what I'm doing now. So there's many things that have become a lot easier to understand when it comes to game development.
Ori and the Blind Forest was valuable to Gareth's growth as a composer, but played directly into his passions as a gamer. Although it was his first big project professionally, it was by no means his introduction to video games as a whole. An actual history with the medium, and a deep-seated love for it, tends to follow the industry's best musicians, who often use their familiarity with common tropes to achieve inventive results in the audio. Gareth is no exception to that, and his background as a genuine fan constantly informs his writing.
I've been playing games since I was 4, and I think it's the medium I know best, and I understand best, and I think I understand, or at least have a decent amount of good taste to know what a player might want. Now, obviously every player is different, but there are some things that I think if you play a lot of games, you can recognize. Like, I know what good controls feel like. I know what bad controls are like. I know what a good camera is. I know what a bad camera is. I know what good art design is. I know what good art production is. There's a difference between technical art, and there's a difference between, like, art in terms of the aesthetic. I feel like I've played more games than I've watched films. It's probably not true, because games take so long. But I feel like I've played enough to have a good understanding of what the player wants. And just one last thing, I think the stories that you're able to tell in games are almost limitless in potential compared to film, because you don't really have to worry about how you're going to shoot something. You don't have to worry about the cost of computer graphics, because everything's a computer graphic, and you don't have to worry about reshoots like you do in film or television. So there's a lot more scope, I think.
It would be a mistake for any musician entering the world of VGM to underestimate its intricacies. Game music is vastly different to film or TV scores, and comes with its own set of philosophies. It has to react to any playstyle, from aggressive speedruns to contemplative dawdles, all while towing a line that stays true to each setting. But music should never be a purely technical endeavour, and capturing the right mood is just as important as reflecting player input.
I think once you've learned the technical side of composing for games, just the fact that games are non-linear and you have to write looping music and the music has to be interactive and try and reflect the player's journey. Once you've got your head around that, ultimately you're still kind of dealing with emotions and vibe. What does what is the player supposed to be feeling at any given moment, and how can the music, or lack of music, because silence is also music too, how can the music help aid the player's experience? That is the number one goal for me. How can I improve the player's experience when they're playing the game? In terms of the actual writing of the music, I feel like all of the, whether it would be a game or a film or a TV show or a song, at the end of the day, I'm dealing in emotion and storytelling. So that's always the most important thing for me when I'm writing a track. I don't really believe that there's any special skill that you need musically to write for games, other than it's a non-musical skill. You need to understand how games work, how they are made, and most importantly, I think you need to play games, or at least have a good idea of how games are played. So even if that's just, if for example, if you weren't a gamer, have someone play it for you, so you can at least get an understanding of what it's like. But I think there's nothing like being able to have the controller in your hands and try and imagine a musical experience for the player that way.
In a platform game, like Ori and the Blind Forest, rhythm is profoundly important to how players progress. As a gigantic fan of the genre from my own childhood, I've become acutely aware of the underlying rhythms that influence movement through a level. Some of the finest examples can be heard in Donkey Kong Country, or the many Rayman side-scrollers that inspired Ori itself. You can fall into relatively strict tempos when platforming, where jumps and attacks become like musical embellishments in a song you have to learn and perform. How does Gareth make sure that his soundtrack isn't at odds with that, and instead sits comfortably with the action?
When the player is running, it's going to be the same speed no matter what. If you're holding the controller all the way to the left, it's going to be the same speed. And what I tend to do is, at the beginning of a project, if it is a platformer or a project with a lot of movement, I tend to make a recording of the character just moving around the environment. And then I just fiddle around with the metronome to see what kind of clicks. And there's no really hard or fast answer, but you know it when you feel it. So often it can just be a case of putting a metronome up against the game footage and then just listening to the character's footsteps and watching the character move and then getting a feel for the right tempo. And it's so easy to adjust tempo in music software. It actually doesn't take a huge amount of time. But then what happens is you start to have a range of tempos that it feels like they're going to work. And I kind of do that. That's usually the starting point, no matter what game I'm working on. Like, what is the right tempo? Because it informs so many choices. And sometimes what you think might be the right tempo might end up being completely terrible. For example, if there's a really high intensity combat scene, you might think, oh, I've got to have a really fast piece of music. But actually, sometimes it can make it feel more epic by slowing it down and letting the sound effects do the work of the really fast-paced stuff. Because if you have a lot of swords clashing or bullets whizzing past your head, that's very, very percussive, and it's almost a musical element. So the music doesn't need to do the same thing. It can actually do something completely different and take a step back. It can still be intense, but not through a rhythmic sense, but in a more compositional sense, like, for example, just using high strings sustained over a lot of low, punchy bullet sounds, is still going to be intense, just not in the way you might expect.
Today, and rightly so, dynamic music rules the roost when it comes to representing your movements in-game. The previous episode of this series, Hollow Knight, which also covers an acclaimed modern platformer, gives significant time to Christopher Larkin's clever use of layered stems. Yet, the problem of player input, which only really shows up in VGM, can be solved in several ways. In Ori and the Blind Forest, Gareth strangely eschewed the standard notion of interactivity in his score. It does flow and react as you progress, but without fading between concurrent channels, or even drawing from a well of smaller, separated elements, like in Left 4 Dead or No Man's Sky. Gareth instead used Ori's 4-year development to gain an exhaustive understanding of its smallest details, then meticulously structured his cues and the subtle transitions between them.
All of the events across the entire game are triggered by the player. There's no beat matching, because frankly there are not that many grooves in the game, so we don't really have many clashes with percussion instruments that are falling off the beat. It really is just all done by the player, and that's what makes it feel interactive. The irony is that the game feels like it's interactive music, but actually there isn't really an interactive music system behind it. All it is very, very granularly placed music cues, and the only reason that they're placed so carefully is because I played the game for hundreds of hours. If we just take the opening of the game, I've done it so many times I can do the whole thing from memory. So Ori wakes up, the bass loop plays for the Sunken Glades. Ori goes down and walks to the left, jumps over the water, you hit the save point, and then you come into like this mini conflict with the ram monster. So a little loop plays there, and the transition point for the loop is when the ram bursts out of the rocks. So the bursting out of the rocks has a sound effect that covers up the music transition. Then the ram hits the rocks and takes himself out, and then a stinger plays, and the transition into the stinger is covered up by the falling of the rocks that the rams just run into. Then you walk further to the left, another ambient music loop plays. Then you jump up and you pick up Sign. A little stinger plays when you pick up Sign. Again, that's triggered by the player, so the music transitions seamlessly. And then a combat cue plays, and then we use the monster sounds to cover up the transition into the combat cue when you defeat the monsters after the when you defeat the monsters, the combat cue finishes, and then another stinger plays.
For such a complex musical web to actually work in a satisfying way, Gareth couldn't just throw his music on top of pre-existing animations. It relied on a lot of collaboration, which can be seen time and time again behind the scenes of Ori and the Blind Forest. Of course, all titles, except those with solo developers, feature collaboration at their core, but Moon Studios encouraged going the extra mile. That's why the score's woodwinds can sound like they're naturally drifting from the game world itself, as if they're glittering through its branches and bouncing off bark.
The cool thing about Ori is that they want me to pace the music so that it feels good musically, and then they build the animation around it. So the way it normally works for cutscenes is I get storyboards, and then I write to the storyboards, and then the animation team kind of times it roughly to the storyboards. There's a constant back and forth just so we can really nail in the timings to make stuff feel really good, so we don't have moments that linger too long, and also that it doesn't feel rushed. So I think that's the main bit of collaboration as far as I'm concerned. But also when it comes to the gameplay, it's nice for the teams who have gameplay music in their relatively early, just so they can get a feel for what things, how things might feel like when they put all the elements together. I think the coolest thing about working on Ori, and it's not the case with every game because not every game is going to give you the kind of access that I have, especially projects from really large companies. Moon Studios is still relatively small. But in the case of Moon Studios, I do have a lot of access, and you're just able to discuss things very easily and make a lot of progress without having to go through too many channels. And that can lead to a really cohesive end product, because I'm usually in contact with animation and sound. I'm rarely in contact with art. I really have no need to be in contact with the design or programming team. But the design team and the programming team are obviously constantly talking to each other. Animation and art are constantly talking to each other. So there's a lot of cross-pollination going on.
Within Moon Studios, no department toils in a vacuum. For them, communication is key, which is exactly why Ori is such a unique adventure, brimming with personality. One of Gareth's hardest, but most important tasks was crafting a main theme to encapsulate that personality. To make the job even more difficult, such themes usually show up repeatedly in several arrangements, meaning they have to be strong enough to avoid irritating listeners. At what point did Gareth hit on the central melody heard throughout Ori and the Blind Forest? And how did he keep it sounding fresh across multiple appearances?
Discovered the main theme about kind of 2 years before the game came out. And I think we just realized that it was strong enough to be reused and not be annoying. But it's also got enough shape that it can be morphed into something else entirely. There's a lot of ways to develop that theme, a lot of ways to reuse it. Even if it's just throwing it on another instrument, it's very malleable. I think that's any theme that is, or motif that is, one that is going to stand the test of time, one that is going to last, has to be malleable. It can't just exist in one form. And with its malleability, I was able to just use it in almost every area of the game in a slightly different way. So it's presented in its base form on the main menu, but then you hear it in different contexts throughout the game, and it is really Ori's theme. So the game is Ori's journey, so you kind of want to hear it reinforcing Ori for the whole way, basically.
Besides the main theme, each area tends to come with its own melody. In fact, there are many distinct themes in Ori and the Blind Forest, ranging in size from longer location tracks to brief cues that pepper specific events or achievements. In some ways, writing a lengthier piece of music is easier, allowing for plenty of time to sink into the atmosphere and develop ideas. In a short loop or momentary flourish, a lot has to be conveyed in a vastly limited time frame, requiring a practiced knack for musical brevity.
With those short cues, if whether they're stingers or like mini loops, you know, what mood am I trying to convey in the time that I have? If you can't use a motif, then if you don't have time to present a motif, then at least get the vibe across with the instrumentation and orchestration. There's always solutions, but with a game, I think the most important thing is to make sure that you have the gameplay clip lined up so you can write to it, and then you have the best idea of what is going to feel good. If you're writing in a vacuum, if it's just like another cue on a spreadsheet of cues, you're not really going to have any context for how it's going to be played back in the game, and that's going to make your job 100 times harder. Whereas if you have the gameplay clip that needs the really short cue, then you can write to it and figure it out. So it's always the advice I have to any like game composer is like get as much footage and information as you can. Normally it's available, but just sometimes you have to ask for it.
No matter the length of any given track, it should always feel tied to the experience. That's where communication is most useful to the creation of VGM, by providing composers with all the inspiration and influence they need to appropriately score each setting. Without a clear idea of a scene, how it looks, and the various ways it could potentially play out, all the music can do is guess. That will always result in a compromised vision, but fortunately, it rarely happens today. The industry has evolved so much that a single game can now journey through a long list of diverse palettes, each designed to reflect a specific locale.
With Ori, almost all of the palette decisions were informed by what I was seeing from the artistic side. And they're usually the most obvious choices. I've definitely regularly referenced this. There's an area in the game called the Valley of the Wind, and the featured instrument is a wind instrument. it seems obvious, but you've still got to do it. The Ginzo tree area of the game takes place inside a tree, so I'm using wooden percussion instruments like marimba and other wooden percussion instruments like woodblock or xylophone, and just combining those together. It's not exclusively wind instruments, but they're kind of wood instruments. But they're kind of the feature. For the icy area of the game, the Forlorn Ruins, what is a cold sound? Well, a cold sound to me is something metallic. So we've got several gongs from Thailand in there. Thai gongs have a really unique and special sound. But they're not just played with mallets, they're also bowed as well. And bowed metal is a very icy, cold sound to my ears. So I'm really just looking at the visuals and thinking what instrument represents the visual of this in my head the best way. And obviously I'm hoping it matches up with what the player might expect. There's no guarantee, but I usually try out a lot of different things, and then one solution becomes the most obvious.
The lion's share of Ori's instrumentation is authentic, drawing largely from the Nashville Music Scoring Orchestra. The orchestra themselves have become a repeated collaboration for Gareth, who utilised them again throughout his 5 albums for Minecraft. But a developing video game project can't rely on a stack of written scores and hope that a final studio performance will do them justice and fit the game. So how do composers prepare and test their orchestral writing before any recording sessions?
Everything has to be mocked up in MIDI before it gets recorded, and it has to be approved as well. That's pretty standard nowadays. I don't think you would get a recording approval if the MIDI mock-ups weren't any good. Fortunately, it's a skill that I am pretty good at. I've honed it for quite a while, and I make it a point to make sure I'm technologically up to date. So I'm pretty comfortable doing that. And also, I think it also puts the team at ease when things transition over to, you know, the recording phase. They know it's going to sound better than what they have, but what they have already works, so it's kind of like a good fail safe.
Rendering a piece entirely in MIDI helps the rest of the team gain a feel for it, but it also solidifies the sound and direction for Gareth. Ori and the Blind Forest was his first OST to use any kind of live orchestra, and that's not something you can jump into head first. Fortunately, the final results are stunning, with the composition's strength complemented by the Nashville Music Scoring Orchestra and their consummate professionalism.
It was not only my first orchestral recording for a score, but yeah, it was. So that meant it was obviously my first time working with Nashville. It's also my first time in Nashville. They obviously did a good job, because I feel like I've recorded with them about 10 more times since. So yeah, I think the thing that struck me the most about them was how quick they were. Their sight reading ability is unbelievable. Yeah, they were a pleasure to work with. We recorded 2 hours of music in 1.5 days, which is quite unprecedented. I think the only reason we were able to do it is because we were very, very well prepared, and the players did such a great job. So, yeah, it was an amazing experience.
Getting things right in the studio is one thing, but achieving that with a tight deadline is entirely another. Although the music had already been written, arranged, and tested in the game with MIDI, live performance can take some time and effort to perfect. But efficiency, without sacrificing quality, is among the Nashville Music Scoring Orchestra's greatest skills. They worked at a similar speed for multiple Minecraft albums too, making them ideal for large soundtrack projects with looming release dates. What exactly does a session with the scoring orchestra look like? And how much does Gareth interact with the players?
Generally, take one is kind of like a rehearsal, but it usually sounds pretty good even on take one. Then I'll usually give notes to the conductor or to the orchestra directly. So I normally sit in the control room, and my conductor, Alex Rudd, he's out there with the musicians. Alex understands my music and what I want to achieve with it. Thus, he's the perfect conductor for me. So he can already relay a lot of stuff to the musicians that he knows that I want already. But if that's not being picked up, then I just give feedback directly to them anyway. If we're having technical issues in the studio, which, you know, does happen, you know, he'll just tell a war story to the orchestra and he'll have them laughing for like 5 minutes, which is, it's very useful to have someone like that. It's kind of a, it's almost like a good cop, bad cop relationship, whereas unfortunately I'm the bad cop, but Alex can relay the information in a way that is palatable to the orchestra. It's a constant collaborative process, but equally it's also about chemistry. If you're being too hard on the musicians all the time, they'll still play the music, but really you're trying to keep the mood and energy high for as long as possible. And that's when the real magic happens.
Magic is an appropriate word for Ori and the Blind Forest's music, though it doesn't just come from live orchestra. The performances give life and depth to the score, but they're almost always mixed with synths, pads, and electronic effects. Such elements usually take a restrained backseat to the more prominent orchestral sounds, quietly adding to the fantastical feel and subconsciously helping with rhythm. Authentic instrumentation carries most of Gareth's melodies and main themes, so it was up to synths to establish a unique tone.
This is one of the great myths about Ori, is that it's an orchestral score. It's really a score with an orchestral element, but there is so much that isn't orchestral in the score. The thing I like to highlight, and most people don't really notice it because it's not in the forefront of the mix, but in almost every cue there's some kind of pulsing element, especially with the gameplay cues. And the pulsing element goes back to that tempo thing that we were talking about earlier. The pulsing element is designed to make you feel the tempo almost subconsciously and to kind of keep you being pushed forward. It's a big part of the Ori music DNA. If you listen carefully, in almost every track, there's some kind of ostinato or pulse going through the entire track. But what you really hear, though, is usually the melodies or the rich chords being provided by strings or other orchestral instruments. But there's a lot going on in the background that supports all of the orchestral stuff. And I think it's a big part of Ori's sound. It's actually just a big part of my sound in general. Not having synthetic stuff be at the forefront if it's an orchestral score, but it's always just kind of sitting there.
Every episode of this series so far has taken a look at synthesized sounds and the various ways of generating and producing them. VGM composers employ so many different methods and combinations of equipment that none give the same answer when asked about their setup. Many don't even stick to one path as technology improves. You can hear more about Gareth's approach to synths in our previous Minecraft episode. But what did he use for Ori and the Blind Forest?
I mean, I definitely use Omnisphere because I think everyone uses Omnisphere. But also for pads, I like to use Diva and Zebra HC, which are both products by UAG, who make amazing synths. Those are the three that are usually coming up most often. Anything else, I'm generally customizing. So for example, to make pad sounds, I'm usually just going crazy with reverb, just taking orchestral sounds or organic sounds and then dialing up like an infinite reverb and then seeing what happens, and then just capturing that kind of capturing the result basically, and then turning it into a pad that I can use.
Gareth's synths flow naturally alongside the Nashville Music Scoring Orchestra, who weren't alone in providing live performance to the score. They're accompanied by some talented soloists too, such as Eiralee Brighton, whose mesmerising voice appears in many important themes. She also contributed her vocal talents to Mean Green's Plastic Warfare and Minecraft's Greek Mythology Pack, both of which were composed by Gareth. Eiralee even took on some voice acting for Ori and the Blind Forest by performing the key role of Sign, a loyal guide and Ori's main weapon. The character speaks a mysterious language, created for the game, which punctuates the setting and its spiritual inhabitants. But Eiralee's singing is used sparingly throughout the game. Nevertheless, it's integral to Gareth's palette, and one of the very first sounds heard by players.
I found her on YouTube before she'd released anything major in terms of games publicly. And then I found out that she lived 10 minutes away from my house. So we kind of got together and put some music together, and it was really kind of a match made in heaven, especially for this game. Her voice is perfect for the game. In terms of using her voice in the project, we did try using it during gameplay, but her voice was so powerful it ended up kind of being a bit not distracting, but it's like you kind of want to stop and listen to it. So we really only use her voice when emotionally, like, we really want to make the player aware that, oh my god, you need to be paying attention now, and that's really when you hear her. So it's kind of like it's like the ultimate weapon, but if you use it too much, that you can have too much of a good thing. So it was a case of like finding the right place to use her voice. So if I think about where her voice is used, it's used in the opening of the game. It's used when you reach the spirit tree for the first time. It's obviously used in the ending sequence fairly frequently. It's just a lot of key moments in the game.
Eiralee is joined on the soundtrack by both Tom Boyd and Rachel Mellis. Tom played live oboe on Up the Spirit Cavern's Waltz, The Waters Cleansed, and Thornfelt Swamp. Despite being one of cinema's most revered and sought-after oboe players, following performances on such classics as Jurassic Park, The Lion King, Forrest Gump, and Aladdin, Ori and the Blind Forest was Tom's first video game credit. Whether you've actually played Ori or not, you're sure to have heard Tom's oboe at some point in your life. So what did such an experienced professional bring to the project?
I don't think wind instruments are that heavily featured in scores nowadays. It's certainly not as much as they used to be. Honestly, my decision on instruments is what feels right for the scene, and it felt good in the mock-up, and I was like, well, let's... And it's an extend. It really is an extended solo, and I was like, well, let's get a really good oboe player to play on this and see what happens. And especially up the Spirit Cavern's walls, is he did a really, really great job on that track. It just felt like it's such a pure sound. And if I recall correctly, both tracks, Up the Spirit Cavern's Walls and The Waters Cleansed, are slightly lighter, more relaxing areas than other parts of the game. And oboe, when you write for it like I did, it can have a soothing quality to it. And I think that's what Tom brought to the table.
The sound of Tom Boyd's oboe leaves its mark on Gareth's soundtrack, even though it only appears in three separate pieces. Rachel Mellis made a similarly profound impression on her own trio of tracks, armed with her personal collection of assorted wind instruments. Her versatility is on prominent display in Minecraft's Chinese mythology pack, and those talents were just as well suited to Ori and the Blind Forest.
Rachel is a flautist, but she has this giant collection of wind instruments, and we featured her on the Bansuri, which is an Indian bamboo flute. And her featured tracks are Riding the Wind and Completing the Circle. She does play on other things too, but those two, I think Completing the Circle is generally considered to be the favorite gameplay track if I look at the Spotify numbers. Obviously there are some cutscene tracks which are more popular, but in terms of tracks that appear during regular gameplay, Completing the Circle I think is the most popular. And she, her take on Bansuri on that, it's just one take, and it's just this really long form thing that she did, and it's just incredible. She's very gifted with that instrument. But she also plays the Irish whistle on Naru Embracing the Light as well. So she's incredibly versatile.
As we reach the final minutes of this podcast, it becomes increasingly clear how much there is to cover in Gareth's music. You can analyse his soundtrack's instrumentation, tone, production, history, and performances, yet still be left with avenues to explore. Usually, I like to spend at least a little time in each episode on the music theory behind a score. In my Minecraft special, for example, Gareth goes into some detail about pentatonic scales and why they're so important to Chinese mythology. Scales essentially form the rules of what notes should be used in any one piece, and how those notes relate to one another.
Different scales, I find, have different characteristics, and this extends into modes. Scales are one thing. Modes are a variation on scales. Different modes and different scales can elicit different feelings from the listener. But at the end of the day, it's just a choice of notes that you're limiting yourself to. And they can be very, very useful when it comes to writing music. For the Misty Woods, I made the decision to use the whole tone scale. The whole tone scale, if you look at a piano, basically the whole tone scale, you are going up the keyboard in whole tones, which is basically two keys. And the cool thing about the whole tone scale is the way it's constructed means it can never resolve, because it doesn't allow you to use harmony that resolves. The cool thing about that is, for an area like the Misty Woods, where the player is supposed to feel lost, well, feeling lost means that there's no resolution. So you want music that also has no resolution. And I struggled for ages with the Misty Woods. And I was like, well, what if I use the whole tone scale? It doesn't resolve. And I was like, oh, this is totally going to work. And I wrote the Misty Woods cue in about 2 hours after that, because all of my problems were solved just by choosing the right scale.
Capturing the essential spirit of a location is probably a VGM composer's biggest responsibility. Players notice when music is at odds with the action on screen, and breaking immersion is the worst mistake a game can make. An inappropriate soundtrack for any area in any game sticks out like a sore thumb, usually to hilarious results. That's just one of the reasons why Gareth's work for Ori and the Blind Forest is so highly regarded. His OST simply sounds like the world, and carefully matches every step of gameplay. When it came time for Ori's Definitive Edition, which featured two new areas, the atmosphere continued seamlessly. At what point did Gareth start developing tracks for that Definitive Edition? And how does it feel to expand on a set score?
That was a separate production for the whole studio, so that's started almost immediately after we finished after we shipped the first game in March 2015. So the Definitive Edition happened for the year after, so we went back and did a separate recording for the little extra areas that we had there. It was about 15 minutes extra of music, I think. I was just happy to be able to revisit the world, to be honest. I'm, you know, it's obviously the same with Ori and the Will of the Wisps. I'm happy, you know, I'm so lucky to have had multiple bites at this cherry, because it's such a cool world for me to play around in musically.
The fully fledged sequel, Ori and the Will of the Wisps, is currently set for release just a couple of months after this podcast, at the beginning of February 2020. All promotion so far suggests that Moon Studios have another success on their hands, and their keen artistic sensibilities remain in full stead. With Gareth Coker returning alongside the rest of the team, you can at least expect a deep and emotional journey in the music. But, with the studio's creatives constantly inspiring each other, it's practically guaranteed that Will of the Wisps itself will satisfy. That's because, in the right circumstances, games can offer one of the most expressive environments available. Ori and the Blind Forest comes from exactly that, and shows just what can happen without the constraints of AAA publishers, or the demands that come with them.
Right now, it's probably one of the most exciting times to be working in video games. The industry is still growing. I feel like the game industry is kind of like that precocious teenager. It's really, really talented, but still has to figure some things out before it really puts all the pieces together. I feel like, as a metaphor, that's where the game industry is right now. So there's some really, really cool stuff happening, but I still think we're like a decade, maybe 2 decades away from actually being in the golden era of games.
Thanks to Gareth for speaking to me for the sound test, but thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you may be listening on. This first mini run of ST2 is now taking a short break for Christmas, before returning in 2020 with the rest of the series. There are still plenty more episodes to come in the new year, with a whole host of insightful guests to look forward to. However, until then, my channel will still be active with live VGM radio shows and streams. In addition, all my Patreon supporters gain exclusive access to unedited interviews, and hear ST2 episodes ahead of their public release. So head on over to patreon.com/_secretcave to offer your support. Finally, there are many other VGM-based rewards to tide over listeners until the new year, and plenty more free interviews on my channel. But I hope you enjoyed this first taste of ST2.